This is ground control to Major Tom. You've really made the grade. And the papers want to know whose shirts you wear. And I'm floating in a most peculiar way. And the stars look very different today.
Hello and welcome to Season 3, Episode 5 of Space Talks, a half-hour science-based show with an interest in all things space. I'm Stephen Lowry, along with co-host Tim Woods on Vancouver Island. And hello, Tim. Tell us about today's topic.
Sure. Today, we're going to delve a little deeper into a topic that we've been discussing earlier on Space Talks, and that's the solar wind. But unlike that last episode, which had a focus on the so-called wind and its effect on Earth, this time we're going to be examining how it affects spacecraft in general and specifically how a previously mentioned concept of solar sails as a means of propulsion works. But first, as is our custom, we have a couple of updates. And just before we get to those, we have to correct a slip of the tongue that was made in the last episode when we were talking about Canadian observatories. So back then, we were drawing a distinction between similar sounding names of the Dominion Observatory in Ottawa and the Dominion Astrophysical Observatory in Victoria. But in a couple of enthusiastic instances, I'm afraid we refer to the latter as the Dominion Astronomical Observatory.
Tim, our mistake of juxtaposing astronomical for astrophysical perhaps is understandable, but it is significant. So would you remind us of the difference between astronomical and astrophysical?
Coming up. So both astronomy and astrophysics explore the vast expanse of outer space, but astronomy focuses on observation and data analysis in the sciences, which is what the observatory in Ottawa has been focused upon. On the other hand, astrophysics delves into the theoretical aspects of celestial phenomenon, which was the prime function of the observatory in Victoria. Now, Ottawa was primarily used for exact timekeeping, whereas Victoria determined our place in the Milky Way galaxy. Now, on to this week's updates. Here's a name, Steve, that we haven't mentioned previously, Oleg Kononenko. Turns out he's a Russian cosmonaut who set quite an amazing record in September of this year. He's been earning a lot of frequent flyer points up there orbiting the Earth on board the space station, and that dates back to his first trip in 2008. On his most recent trip, however, he set a record, not for the number of trips to space, but the total number of days in space. And Steve, if this were a trivia contest, I'm pretty sure I could stump you with this one. Can you name the astronaut with the most trips to space? Should be easy.
You know, Tim, the only name that really comes to mind is that of one of my heroes, John Young, who had 6 flights to space and he walked on the moon. But from the way in which you phrased your question, I think that he's been well surpassed.
Yes, Steve. But first off, it was a tie between a guy named Jerry Ross and Franklin Chang Diaz. Those two hold the record. They each made 7 trips to space, and all of them were to the space shuttle or on board the space shuttle. And so that is a pretty old record that they set, because that program, well, it's been on the shelf since 2011. So this new record by cosmonaut Oleg Kononenko is for the total duration of his 5 flights, all of those to the International Space Station. And the answer to how long he's been in space is, drumroll please, 1,111 days in space. And Steve, that translates into some 16,000 trips around our province, or in fact around the world. And I can't imagine the number of frequent flyer points he would have racked up. But we don't tend to know too much about these modern day astronauts, cosmonauts, and taikonauts, because there are just too many of them. And that's particularly the case with cosmonauts, let alone Chinese taikonauts. So, cosmonaut Kononenko was the commander during this last trip to the space station, and though he is incredibly accomplished, he's apparently a fairly quiet guy who likes to play volleyball when he's back here on Earth. And the bottom line is, this dude is 60 years old, and he spent 3 of those years orbiting our planet. Quite incredible.
Thanks for that, Tim. I had no idea. And that's another, shall we say, new to me, unknown space nugget. Now, my update this week recalls a topic we mentioned in the first episode this season, and that is of SAR satellites. I realize that when most people in BC hear of SAR, they immediately think of search and rescue, and perhaps rightly so. However, with regard to space, we did mention that Canada was one of the first nations to build and use SAR satellites, and in this case, the acronym SAR does not stand for search and rescue, it stands for synthetic aperture radar.
Right. And we did make mention of Canada's RADARSAT-1, which was launched in 1995 and became operational until 2013, far outliving its intended 5-year lifespan. So that was good news.
We also mentioned in episode one that Canada now operates three identical SAR satellites called the RADARSAT Constellation Mission, or RCM, and it provides the world's most advanced, comprehensive method of maintaining Arctic sovereignty, conducting coastal surveillance, and ensuring maritime security. And that's because SAR can see through clouds and also works at night, unlike optical telescopes. However, let's never forget this doesn't mean that the US doesn't have SAR satellites and it uses them for military purposes. So today's update is that just this September, amateur astronomer Felix Schoffenbanker in Austria captured images of one of the five super secret American Topaz satellites, and they employ SAR imaging for military purposes. Intrigued of us coincidentally mentioning SAR satellites just a few weeks ago, I decided to delve a bit into the technical side of how SAR satellites work.
Well, right off the bat, Steve, I've noticed that the acronym SAR has itself an acronym within it. The word radar is the acronym for.
Radio detection and ranging.
And so SAR actually means, you ready for this? Synthetic aperture radio detection and ranging. What a mouthful, and hooray for acronyms.
I couldn't agree more, Tim. And now there's an interesting difference between traditional optical telescopes and SAR telescopes, and I've inserted the word telescope here to better understand the sciencey stuff, shall we say, which deals with our old friend electromagnetic radiation and its respective wavelengths. Visible light and invisible radar are the same except for their frequency and wavelengths. Visible light has very short wavelengths compared to radar wavelengths. To capture light requires only a relatively small lens or aperture, as demonstrated by the width of our pupils in our eyes, which admit light. On the other hand, radar waves are much longer and require very wide antennas.
So we need an analogy here, and it's time to make things a little simpler to understand. So let's say you're trying to catch a falling object. And if it's small, like, well, baseball, you only need a baseball glove, a small glove. But if it's larger, like somebody jumping out of a burning building, you're going to need a big trampoline-sized net to do any good.
Exactly so, Tim. We mentioned before how in 1968 Canada was the first country to establish an artificially wide antenna by linking the Algonquin Radio Observatory in Ontario to the Dominion Radio Astrophysical Observatory in Penticton, BC, to create an artificially wide 3,000-kilometer antenna. And the purpose of all that effort was to create clear images from radio waves. Oh, and don't forget that radio waves can be used interchangeably for radar waves for our purposes here today. Now, with that size of scale in mind, a satellite in space would need to have a huge antenna about 4.5 kilometers wide to obtain good resolution and produce a good picture.
And obviously, that's going to be pretty hard to launch or assemble in space and operate. Something that large would be impractical at this point in time. So I believe it turns out that SAR satellites actually use a much smaller antenna, which is only 3 meters wide. So the question is, how does a 3-meter antenna become as useful as one that's 4,500 meters wide?
Well, this is where I had to do some research, and the answer is to create an artificially huge antenna. And there's where the term synthetic aperture comes into play. Synthetic means artificial, and aperture simply means an opening, as mentioned, just as the pupil in your eye is an aperture.
So here's where you're going to tell us how that's done, and without using some mind-boggling math, I hope.
You can rest assured of that, Tim. Listeners are readily aware that satellites aren't stationary when they're in orbit. They're traveling at velocities in excess of 8 kilometers per second. Now, at that speed, if the satellite pulses down a radar signal, by the time it hits the Earth and rebounds way back to the satellite, which is some 600 kilometers overhead, the satellite would have traveled some distance before receiving that returning signal. That distance traveled is, in essence, the size or aperture of the antenna. Well, let's use another analogy here, Tim. Let's say that you place a basketball, which has some manufacturing markings on it, on a table, and that basketball represents the Earth. Now place one fingertip about 5 centimeters above the basketball and slowly move it along, and your fingertip is representing the satellite. And let's say that you're passing over the word Rawlings, which might be etched in the side of the basketball, or maybe you're just interested in looking at the inflation valve. As you move your finger, imagine that it sends out a radar beam at that mark, or the word Rawlings, and imagine that beam is traveling to the surface and bouncing back to your fingertip while your fingertip has been moving. The distance between where your fingertip was when you sent the signal and where it is when it gets the reflected signal is the width of the synthetic or make-believe aperture.
So now the rather interesting thing is that unlike an optical spy satellite, which tends to look straight down at what's below, SAR sends out sideways radar pulses, thus increasing the distance to the object and increasing the size of the aperture, and thus creating an even clearer image. Now I also found out that SAR is the son of SLAR, which is the acronym for side-looking airborne radar, and that was first developed for spy aircraft. So the concept was first used in aircraft and then later for satellites.
Okay, I'm sure our listeners are tired of all that, but I do know that interested listeners can easily find a plethora of information and animations on the web to help them understand this concept. Don't be afraid to use AI searches for your answers. Microsoft Copilot is one which is readily available. It's free and easy to use. And Tim, I think that you use ChatGPT a lot, don't you?
I do, and I certainly use it for this episode today. But the main topic today is the dilemma of massless photons, and I'm sure listeners are anxious to find out why this is becoming so perplexing for you, Steve, and how did this particular topic come to mind?
Well, Tim, it's not unusual for me to think about the mysteries of science late at night, especially after perusing some YouTube channels or doing some online magazine reading. The other night, something in episode 3 began to gnaw away at me, and it caused me to remember some high school physics, and then I got rather puzzled. After reporting on solar sails in episode 3, I got to thinking more deeply about how could photons of light impart a force upon a reflective panel in space. In that episode, we talked about how the concept of solar sails was first envisaged as science fiction, whereby spacecraft, once in orbit, could erect somewhat large reflective sails to capture sunlight and use that as a method of accelerating the craft. The first concept we have to remember is that once on a trajectory in space, it isn't necessary to keep firing rockets to maintain a velocity. And that's despite, well, those old science fiction movies where the spaceship was always firing its rocket. No, Newton's first law of motion states that a body tends to remain in constant speed and direction unless acted upon by another force.
So what that means then is that those spacecraft in orbit around our planet are going about 28,000 kilometers per hour, and when they cut off their engines, they just keep moving at that same speed.
Exactly. But if you want to accelerate and boost your velocity, you have to fire up the rockets again. And of course, your spacecraft has a limited amount of fuel on board. But if you could use the sun's light or photons, then that fuel is limitless from the sun, and you can keep accelerating, going faster and faster.
Okay, just a minute though. I get the feeling that we're at that point, as again, we've been there before, where you think, the more I know, the less I know. So, what is it that caused you to question this notion of using sunlight then?
Well, as a youngster, when I first read of this concept, I didn't think through, let alone know, the physics of momentum. And since then, I learned that, as I'm sure we all have, momentum equals mass times velocity. To use a simple example, let's say you're out with your friends and decide to go bowling. You throw a ball, which has an average mass of 1.5 kilos, at an average speed or velocity of 20 kilometers per hour. And that 20 kilometers per hour equates to 6 meters per second.
Okay, so to review then, you've got a 1.5 kilogram mass moving along at 6 meters per second. And since the formula that we're using is mass times velocity, the bowling ball has a momentum of 6 times 1.5, which is, of course, 9. So the momentum of the bowling ball is 9 kilograms per meter per second. What's the problem?
Well, the problem isn't quite there, Tim. And as you say, the math is pretty simple because, after all, if you throw that same ball at twice the velocity, the momentum is going to double and be 18. So there's no problem there. It's really kind of straightforward. And you can rather have some fun with that. You can pose the question to a friend of, would you rather be hit by a 7 kilogram bag of feathers moving at a velocity of 60 meters per second, or a 21 kilogram bag of marshmallows moving at a slower velocity of 20 meters per second? The feathers have a momentum of 7 times 60, or 420 kilograms per second, and the marshmallows have a momentum of 21 times 20, or hey, they're both the same, 420 kilograms per second. However, in either case, it doesn't matter if you get hit by the marshmallows or the feathers, you'd get smushed.
See, I can hear my dad joking to me that I'd gone soft in the head, which would be related to imagining marshmallows or feathers hitting one at that kind of a speed. It's going to hurt. Anyway, but putting the fun aside, whatever has this got to do with the sun's massless photons and spacecraft with solar sails?
Well, that's the whole point. I had forgotten that photons of light are massless. They have no weight.
All right, so I can see what we're up to here. So if momentum equals mass times velocity, and even though a photon moves at the blazing speed of 300,000 kilometers per second, which is, of course, the speed of light, when the equation is multiplied by a mass of zero, the answer is zero. Anything multiplied by zero, you get zero. It would appear that light doesn't, therefore, have momentum and shouldn't be able to push against a solar sail, and yet we know it does.
And therein lay part of my faulty thinking. The solar wind consists of streams of charged particles released from the sun's outermost atmospheric layer. These are mainly subatomic particles like protons, electrons, and alpha particles. And I used to think that sunlight, or photons, was a constituent part of the solar wind, but no, that's not the case. Although photons can interact with the solar wind, they aren't part of it.
Okay, so part of your thinking was faulty, and that's okay. Don't beat yourself up, Steve. But how about the dilemma of photons having no mass but still having momentum? How does that work?
Great question, Tim. And I had to search the web first and then resort to using AI to get the answer. Even though photons are massless, they still carry momentum. And that's what really puzzled me. And this is due to the principle of radiation pressure. When photons hit the reflective surface of a solar sail, they transfer momentum to it, generating a small force that can gradually accelerate the spacecraft. This exerted radiation pressure depends on the intensity of the photons and whether the surface absorbs or reflects the light. Reflecting surfaces double the transfer of momentum because the photons bounce off, giving an extra push.
So, for light, we can't use the momentum formula of mass times velocity. We need another one, a new formula for the formula of photon momentum. And Steve, what is it?
Well, as the politician Pierre Trudeau once said, the universe is unfolding as it should. And perhaps he was thinking of the great Albert Einstein, who formulated this light pressure equation as E equals PC, where E is energy, P is momentum, and C is the speed of light. And this shows that photons can have momentum even without mass, thanks to their energy.
Well, we all know Einstein's famous equation, E equals mc squared, but I have to admit, I didn't know he also came up with this one, E equals pc. So small wonder he won a Nobel Prize for that equation, and not for his theory of relativity, but for the photoelectric effect which he used to derive E equals pc. Now that's one fact that I think very few people knew.
Yes, and as our old friend Ron Popeil would say, but wait, there's more. Photon propulsion involves the reflection of momentum and the concept of cumulative pressure. Now, Newton's third law, for every action, there's an equal and opposite reaction, means that when photons hit a reflective surface, like a solar sail, they push it while bouncing away. The sail gets a small continuous push in the opposite direction of the incoming photons, and that gradually accelerates the spacecraft. Einstein determined that photons, which hit a metallic surface, also caused that surface to emit electrons from the metal. This he called the photoelectric effect. Perhaps a simple, but understandably somewhat inaccurate way of understanding this is to imagine someone standing securely on a skateboard while motionless on a smooth, level surface. If you throw them a basketball, which represents a photon from the sun, they will accelerate and move away because of momentum. And here's where Einstein's genius comes into effect. Additionally, because of the photoelectric effect, there is a secondary force which comes into play. If the same skateboarder is standing still with a basketball, which now represents an electron from the metallic surface, and they throw the ball to you, they will also accelerate and move. The combination of the photon striking the surface, which causes the spacecraft to move, and the same photon causing an electron to be emitted, both accelerate the spacecraft. It's a two for one.
And with regard to continuous thrust, the sun continues to pump out photons in all directions, and plenty of them. The force from each individual photon, of course, is extremely small. But in the vacuum of space, where there's no friction or air resistance, the force can build up, accumulate over time, gradually accelerating the spacecraft.
So, after doing some research, my dilemma was solved. The massless photons do exert momentum, even though, as we say, they have no mass. I just didn't know all the math, and that's really no surprise.
All of this talk has raised a couple of queries of my own, Steve, and I thought we might try to answer or mention them vis-a-vis massless photons being used as an energy source. Now, first, if the Earth has been subject to all this pressure from solar light for billions of years, why doesn't that pressure push the Earth away from the sun?
You know, Tim, my immediate off-the-cuff response was to think that the massless photons would have no effect on changing Earth's distance from the sun. But again, I was wrong. Radiation pressure from the sun does contribute to pushing the Earth slightly away. However, this effect is very small compared to a couple of other factors. It turns out that the primary reason the Earth is gradually moving away from the Sun is because the Sun is constantly converting mass to energy, and that energy is spewed out in all directions. And secondly, there are tidal forces between the Earth and Sun which cause the Sun's rotation to gradually slow down, which in turn causes the Earth to move slowly away.
We'll never have to worry about this, about moving so far away from the sun that we've become a frozen planet. And why is that? Because long before that happens, the sun will begin to die and become one gigantic swollen red giant star, which will encompass us and vaporize the Earth. Sweet dreams to all. Now, my second question. What about a spacecraft trying to use solar pressure to get from, say, the Earth to Neptune? Would it slow down? Would it be able to slow down and explore that planet? How would it return back to Earth? Could it be turned around, get slung back into the inner solar system using Neptune's gravity? Or are we talking about this just becoming a one-way trip? So, without getting into the serious math of the question I've just posed, it seems unlikely that if you reach the planet Neptune with the kind of speed that could significantly accelerate your spacecraft, you would not be then able to slow it down or even come close enough to Neptune to take advantage of its planetary gravity and sling yourself back to Earth, as they did with Apollo 13. And lastly, I wonder, what other impacts does or might solar wind have on anything at all? For example, the collective impact of solar wind from every sun in the Milky Way.
Well, let me try to answer that question of yours, Tim. Previously, we talked about how dark is space, and it's not at all like in the movies. It's D-A-R-K dark. In effect, there is no photon pressure to be held in deep space, so trying to use Milky Way radiative pressure won't work because it's not there.
Okay, we've covered an awful lot of ground here today, Steve, and I think we've used our last pun too. We hope that you've gained some insight into records for spaceflight and time and space, learned a little bit about synthetic aperture radars, and how massless photons can impart momentum, because we surely have. And so until next time, this is Tim Woods.
And Stephen Lowry's searching the internet for my answers, saying so long, and we'll see you next time on
Space Talks.
Mr. Spaceman, won't you please take me along for a ride?
radio detection and ranging.